In the 66th Mizmor, it opens up Lamnatzeach Shir Mizmor, and if you see carefully, you will notice that it's no attribution to any offer. Doesn't say LeDavid, doesn't say Bnei Korach, doesn't say anyone. It's completely anonymous. Radak doesn't address who's the author. He says that this Mizmor is written with an eye to the future at the time of the ingathering of the exiles and the rebuilding of Israel prior to the coming of HaMoshiach. Ibn Ezra merely points out this Mizmor too is also one of those not written by David and is written by one of the poets. Mitzudot David says, no, this heralds the coming of the Moshiach. And it talks as if he's coming. In other words, it's not even Kibbutz Galuyot, the ingathering that comes before Moshiach, it's actually the coming of the Moshiach. And the Malbim tells us, this was written by Menashe, the son of Chizkiyahu, whose story is told to us in Divrei HaYamim Lamed Gimel, the 33rd chapter of the second book of Chronicles. And what do we know from that book? And what do we know from other places? Menashe was the longest reigning king of the Judean kings. I'm talking about before the Churban Bayis Rishon. Remember that we have a semi-monarchy afterwards. Once Ezra and Nehemiah come back, we have a different kind of, we rebuild Beit HaMikdash, but we don't have the old monarchy that we had before. So I wanted to go through with you this chronicle. Once upon a time, dates or years were counted by the reign of a king. So I will give you the following issue. Presume that a king died in October, and it was the third year of his reign. In October, his son, presumably, would have been coronated, and we would have counted in October. I'm now talking, for instance, because I'm using the Gregorian calendar, the Christian calendar, so January through December. You understand? I'm not talking now about Tishrei, different years. We would have started counting a new year in October. Now, that year would have ended in December, so that would have been year
one.
So I would have had in the previous year 2 years counted. So sometimes when you're given dates or years, in the fifth year of the reign of blah, 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 where am I counting from? Am I counting from the time he's reigning, or am I counting a calendar year? And therefore, that's why you have these variances. In addition, there are terrible differences about when Churban Bayit Rishon was, and more importantly, what happens after in the counting thereafter. You remember that this caused a big problem for none other than Achashverosh, who figured that the 70 years predicted of Galut was over, when in fact it really wasn't. Because it was a question of when do you start counting. Do you count with the fall of the last king and the loss of sovereignty? Or do you count when the then temple is destroyed? In fact, there was 11, 12 years betwixt and between. Just to give you an idea, that can throw things off. Furthermore, most of us, it's nice for us to think in this concept of 5,777 or 76, but when we're thinking, we think such as 2016, common era or AD. When did they start counting? Was zero when he died? Was zero when he was born? In fact, there's about 130 years, give or take, missing somewhere. And a mishmash about when somebody decided to count. And that's why we have variances. So when we look at the variances that I gave you is based on the biblical accounts, when it tells you in the year such and such. But it doesn't give us a calendar year, it gives us the year of his reign. That's why you have sometimes a variance. And were they counting with a lunar calendar, or were they counting with a solar calendar? And when they suddenly decided to move from the Julian to the Gregorian, oh my God, they lost a whole bunch of years there as well. So things kind of got messed up, so we really don't know. Irrelevant. What I do want you to go through with me is we're going to do a quick scan. So we start with David. That's the beginning of the Davidic reign, right? Because before that I have Shaul. He's the first king of Israel, but he comes from the tribe of Binyamin. And this is the Judean king. So he was reigned for 40 years in total. Shlomo HaMelech reigned for 40 years. His son, Rehoboam, Abia, reigned for 3 years. Asa reigned for 41 years. Yehoshaphat, 25 years. Yehoram. There were two Yehorams. Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat, Yehoram ben Nevat. Because that was the king of Israel when they split, you understand? And the split occurred in the days of Rehoboam. All right. Ahaziah reigned for 1 year. And it tells you he was killed by Yehu, who usurped the throne of Israel. Okay, so this is the wars between Jews and Jews. Athaliah, you didn't know we had a queen, was the daughter of Omri. She reigned for 6 years, was murdered. And Yoash, became reigned after her for 40 years. That was followed by Amatziah. The prophet Isaiah lives at this period of time. So you'd see that Amatziah lived for 29 years. And he is killed in Lachish by men sent by his officials who conspired against him. Uzziah. And one of the things that tells us here is a little thing is that the first Olympiad took place. So I just want you to understand that if you're talking about Hellenism and the golden age of Greece, I want you to understand this way precedes it. Okay, then we have Yotam, reigned for 16 years. And we flip. Ahaz. By now the northern tribes have been exiled. The Assyrian Empire has come down and is reigning northern Israel. The Galilee is in their hands. They are approaching Yerushalayim, most of the area of the north. That would include modern day Tel Aviv, Haifa, is all in the hands of the Assyrians. Jews from the north have been exiled to places like Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, definitely Persia, all over. And the incredible thing is the breakup of families. Not unlike what the communists in Russia did. You break up the families, you destroy whatever it is, you understand, and you destroy that union. And you force them, that's forbidden, to speak their natural language so that you switch them around. So if you find out that some of those people have DNA similar to ours, there's a reason for that. They were distributed all over. And that's when you had Jews exiled to India, the B'nai Israel, to China. And why we have Jews in China that have been there since forever, you understand? Just get a sense of this. Ethiopia. So it's the entire civilized world and Ethiopia and Africa. You've got them distributed all over because Assyria is ruling from the area that you think of as the Balkans all the way through till the Indian Ocean. And they control the entire Middle Eastern basin, North Africa. Okay, they even go to war with Egypt and Libya, and they're going down to Africa. People were sold into slavery. People were just distributed. But they did something else. They transferred people, and we suddenly got goyim from many countries in the north coming down to live in Israel. Since the days of Sanherib, you do not know if you belong to the tribe of Yehuda, or then, or bin. Most of us are either Yehuda or Binyamin, unless you're a Kohen or a Levi. We no longer call ourselves Binyamin or anything else. In the days of Chizkiyahu, the Assyrians laid Yerushalayim to siege. That's when Chizkiyahu was told by the prophet Yeshayahu, don't do anything, God is going to save the day. And sure enough, plague broke out. The Assyrians fled for their lives and left corpses the entire area. And it was saved.
And it was
for a while. It was Chizkiyahu, HaMelech Chizkiyahu. Okay?
Who was?
Now Chizkiyahu, you might remember, was sick. And it's one of the names when somebody's very sick, because he was cured, that we give the name Chaim Chizkiyahu, Chizkiyahu. Okay, I have an uncle named Chaim Chizkiyahu because when he was born, my grandmother's sister was laying in the hospital between life and death, and that was a way of trying to create a schut of some sort to save his life. Okay, but
so
that's this kind of thing.
Nephew, you said? Who?
The prophet told him, don't do anything. God said, it's okay, you'll be cured, and Yerushalayim will be saved.
Who
and that's what we
prophet?
Have. Yeshayahu, Isaiah. Okay?
Oh,
Chizkiyahu was succeeded by his son, Menashe, who reigned longer than any other king, 55 years. He murdered Yeshayahu. He also murdered, it said that he committed incest with his sister, you name it, he did it. So you've got this great tzaddik who has a horrific son. And there is a big machloket in the Gemara, one of which says, Menashe is among the people, ein lo chelek leolam haba, has no portion in the world to come. What did he do in his day? He banished the Torah. Those that existed demanded that the name of Hashem be removed from all the scrolls and erased. Writing the Torah was forbidden. He put an Asherah, a statue of the fertility goddess of the Assyrians, in Beit HaMikdash, instituted and forced idolatry, and by pain of death. Now, why did he do this? Because the same Assyrians that during his father's life were decimated managed to recoup and came for a second invasion. And when did he become king? At the age of 12, similar to Shlomo. What happens is he is really a vassal of the Assyrians. Kisses up to them as much as he possibly can. And it's one of those cases, either I let them destroy us, or we become a subject of them. Not some unlike what later on another man did, and that was Herod. Okay? And he did that. So you almost bring the enemy inside yourself, and you become like them, and then you sort of to save your neck, and supposedly your power. So we get stories in Melachim, and then we have stories in Divrei Hayamim, and I will read from you the 33rd chapter in Chronicles 2. Ben 12 shana Menashe b'molchot. He was 12 years old when he was coronated. And it says here, and he ruled 55 years in Yerushalayim. He did whatever was bad in the eyes of God. By the way, everything that's written here is exactly this, almost the same word for word, what's written in other places in the Tanakh. And he did all the abominations of the Goyims, for which God had disinherited them and took away Eretz Yisrael from them. In other words, what the Canaanites and the Amorites and all of them did. Okay. He came back and rebuilt all of the Bamot, all of the altars, which his father, Chizkiyahu, had destroyed. He brought altars for the Baalim and built statues of Asherot. And he had everyone bow down to all the forces of the heavens. Now, the Gemara tells us that he was a tremendous Talmid Chacham, and he found contradictions. If it says in one place that God will do this and this, but God did not do this, then he says that that is a lie. He used all those contradictions, as moderns have done, to claim this is human authorship. I don't believe in the authenticity of the Torah. He also did not believe that there is a God that watches over our actions. There were too many things that looked like coincidences, and it doesn't look like God's, like prayers are being answered. And therefore, it really doesn't make a difference. And when he worshipped the Tzva Shamayim, he worshipped in what he saw as predestination. It's in the stars. In other words, your fate is predetermined with your birth. And so that's why people look at their astrology, remember? When you were born, to whom you were born, and really precious little freedom of, well, choice. What are the forces, when you talk about Baal or Asherah, what are those forces that we are worshipping? The Baal stands for essentially the god of manhood, and it is the male god, that force of sexuality, you understand, as well as military might. Tell me, does might makes right? The answer is, what does history tell you? And who records? So that's the Baal. The Asherah is a goddess of fertility. The other issue is fecundity. the ability to reproduce, and essentially it's not different, though it has ancient terms, from modern biologists who believe in what? Genetics. And your personality is predetermined by your neuroscience and your chemicals in your brain, and by the process of evolution and the fate and the chance of time and the accidents of it. And do you really have any freedom of choice? And the answer is no. And you are driven by what? By unseen, at least to the eye, forces of libido, of violence, that make us no different than other animals programmed to reproduce as much as they possibly can, and survival of the fittest. And therefore, ideas of morality, of caring for the poor, is nonsense, because the weak should die out before they have a chance to survive, for the survival of the species depends on the strong. So you worship strength, you worship fecundity, and so they're celebrating force, power. That's what we celebrate. Because it's best for the survival of the folk, as the Nazis would have had it. It really doesn't come out of any sense of reverence. It's paying tribute. And so remember that when people worshipped idols, it meant they recognized them as forces, and to the degree that you can, you would try to manipulate them to your purpose, or you adjust yourself to that. So if today you open up a newspaper and you read your astrological signs and it tells you that it's not a good day to do whatever it is, and you believe in that, you don't do it. Now you're proving it perhaps scientifically wrong, you understand? But if you try to do it scientifically, as by the way even America did, what would you say would be the rational thing that a society would do if it has a child that's carrying a genetic disorder? Well, if you're not going to kill him, at least do one thing. Sterilize them. Isn't that really the humane thing to do? And what do we do with the elderly that are no longer productive? And what should we do with people who are schizophrenic? Goodness gracious, we now recognize that that is hereditary. Don't you think it's a humane thing for the survival of this society that we, if we don't actually kill them and recognize that they're taking away powerful resources and pose a danger to us, then what do we do with them? They're not crazies. They're completely rational. They're amoral. But they're rational. And so Menashe was a big Talmud Chacham who was amoral. And he did all of these things. And it tells you as follows. Vayiven mizbechot l'chol tzva shamayim b'shtei chatzerot bet Hashem, in both of the courtyards, the courtyard of the women and the court, the other courtyard, there were asherot. V'hu evir et banav ba'esh b'gei ben Hinnom. He even put past his sons through the fire in Gei ben Hinnom. And you thought Gei ben Hinnom is actually the origin of the word Gehenim. Gei ben Hinnom is that chasm right outside the walls of Yerushalayim where they used to have the god, the Molech, and you either sacrificed your child to him, burning them alive, or he actually took his own son. Some say that they no longer did it. It was a little bit more humane. You walked on coals. You went through this ritual. Okay? And all of this to be goy-like. As much as we are like them, we will get along with them. They are the majority. Let's get along. Why are we trying to be particular and so ornery?
So it's assimilation and it's
really... Right. You got it exactly right. Okay. Ve'nichesh ve'kishef. He used magic and tried to divine the times. Vasa ov v'yidoni. And he did some things just like others. It talks about how he put a particular pestle inside the Beit HaMikdash. He did all of this. And he forbade Jews to come on Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot to Yerushalayim. Didn't allow him to come anymore. And by the way, many of the Nevi'im went into hiding. Because if you dared speak against him, off with your head. Vayita menashet Yehuda, he misled all of Judea, veyoshve Yerushalayim lasot ra menagoyim, to do evil even worse than the goyim, whom God had destroyed. Vaydaber Hashem el Menashe velamo, God spoke to Menashe and to his people, velo yikshivu, he didn't speak directly to him, he sent prophets to him, to to warn him that what he's doing is going to bring about devastation, and he wouldn't listen. Well, this part is not told elsewhere, because this is the rest of the story that didn't need to be put somewhere else. And that caused the dispute. Did Menashe ever do tshuva? Are the gates of heaven completely closed to him? Is there any way back? What we hear is this. When he would not listen, Vayaveh Hashem alehem et sarei hatzava asher lemelech Ashur, God brought the army of the Assyrians to take him captive. In a sense, they did not need to conquer Jerusalem, because Menashe did the dirty work for them. So what did they now do when he tried to be a little bit independent? They took him captive to Ashur, and they put him in thorns and in chains, and they brought him to Babel. Actually, they ruled all of that, and they took him, what they saw as their outposts. Very much like, think about Napoleon was taken to the Isle of Elba. Okay, think of it, that kind of thing. They took him there. Ukehatzer lo. And when things got really bad for him, he was put in prison in a dungeon and kept there. Chilat pnei Hashem elokav. He turned in desperation to plead the face of God. Vayikana me'od, and he submitted completely before Hashem Elokei Avotav, before Hashem, the God of his fathers. Vayitpalel elav, and he prayed to him, and he pleaded with him, and God heard his prayer, and he brought him back to Jerusalem, and he was restored to the throne. And Menashe knew finally that Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem is the God. Despite of all the horrible things it did, including, as Chazal tell us, incest and murder. Some insist that he was restored to the throne, but not to Olam Haba. And Rabbi Yehuda says, God made a special tunnel under the throne and let him in out of chesed. Because there's always room for a bal tshuva. Yeah, and there's always way to come back. He built the outer walls of the city of David, Ma'arava la-Gihon, west of the Gihon River, and he continued to fortify the city. You understand? In a sense, he's continuing. He put soldiers to guard all of the walled cities and all the fortifications in Judea. He removed Et Elohei Anechar Vet Asemel Beit Hashem. He removed all the idols that he had built, and he threw them outside of the city. They were destroyed. Vayiven, and he rebuilt God's Mizbeach, and he brought Shlamim Vetoda. He brought offerings. Vayomer LeYehuda, and he led out a decree in Judea that all should worship Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Hashem, the God of Israel. Yeah. All the rest of the story of the chronicle of Menashe and his prayer to God and the words of the prophets that came to speak to him in the name of Hashem, they are all written in the chronicles of the kings of Israel. And his prayer and his plea and his sin and all of that is also described there. And Menashe was laid to rest when he died with his father, and his son Amon ruled after him for all of 2 years when he was assassinated. Amon was not a good guy. He'd been raised by his father and didn't do tshuva. And under him came Yoshiyahu, at which point there was a tremendous religious revival in Israel. But Yoshiyahu, this was in the days of Yirmiyahu. He was a great tzaddik, but against the advice, joined the battle against Necho, the king of Egypt, who was marching up against Assyria, and he intervened where he shouldn't have, and he was killed on the battlefield. And the book of Echa, Lamentations, was originally, not all of it, part of it was written, and then modified for the destruction of Israel, was originally written as a dirge and a eulogy by Yirmiyahu for the king Yoshiyahu, who was a great tzaddik, okay, and made that mistake of mixing in what he shouldn't have. You'll see that his son reigned for all of 3 months, and from there it is a slide down. The Babylonians rose up against the Assyrian, who were their colonial masters. They took over. Nineveh falls. They capture and they come into Eretz Yisrael, all sliding down towards, you see, very short time from there till the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, if you look at this mizmor, as does Malbim, as that prayer written by a man named Menashe, it suddenly makes awful sense. And he points out the following. This mizmor has several places, and you can circle them, where the word Selah appears.
Yeah.
It appears at the end of verse 4, Selah. It appears at the end of verse 7, Selah. It appears at the end of the 15th verse, Selah. And therefore this mizmor divides itself into four parts. The first four parts, until the word Selah, describes God's reign in the world of nature, where his hand is hidden, because we take it for granted and we see it as the laws of nature. In the next section, until the word Selah, in the seventh verse, it is God's leading through open miracles, where the hand of God is no longer hidden and one can see it. The third section speaks to all nations and describes the agony of Menashe when he was taken captive and how he was saved. And the last part speaks to Israel until the end, urging them to join him in the worship of God, now that he has been restored. This is the position of Malbim. Sfono says this poem is written about those in exile and what they need to do in order to bring about the Yeshua. If you'll notice carefully, you will notice that it's actually the following stages. Recognize that the forces of nature are the hidden hand of a creator. Look at the miracles that have occurred and see that he not only created the world, but that he intervenes in the world. Malbim agrees with this, by the way, that open miracle is a way of seeing God intervening in our lives. It's not just that he made it and then abandoned it, but that he's still active in this world. You understand? The third section is describing our suffering, our humiliation, that sometimes is necessary to bring us to our knees when we turn our back to what should be obvious until we finally recognize God again. And the fourth section indicates what happens when we ultimately recognize him and thereby bring about not only our personal redemption, but the redemption of the nation as well as the redemption of the world, because our mission in the world is to also make this known to all humanity. You see how Sfono does this. Radak tells us this is written about the future, because he doesn't tell us who the author is and he doesn't question who the author is. And so therefore he sees this all as something that will happen in the future, but will also comment in between, this is the things we're going through. So there are phrases here that you might not recognize, but that have entered our tefillah. There are sections here that are part of the davening of Ma'ariv. There are sections here that were put into the davening of Yom Kippur. But it's really not that difficult. Let's go and look inside. L'Natzeach Shir Mizmo. Hariyu Lelokim Kol Ha'areh. Hariyu is Tua. It's when they trumpet. And when do you trumpet? When you coronate. I want you to coronate. And who is he calling on to coronate God and to recognize him? Kol Ha'areh. Zamru Kvod Shmo. Sing the glory of his name, the power of his name. Simu kavod tehilato. This is an awkward phrase. Simu is place. Tehilato, his praises. Kavod. It means put your honor to his praise. Praising him is your honor. Imru le'elokim. Say to God. Now you remember that line? There's a whole piyut. Yosha Shana Yom Kippur. Imru le'elokim, say to God. It was actually a paitan in the Middle Ages taking this mizmor and literally taking parts of it and then playing on that theme. Say to God. What should you say to God? Man nora ma'asecha. how awesome are your deeds, your acts. Like what? Like the sunrise, like the sunset, like all natural processes. If you would just look, not take it for granted how awesome they are. But then there's something else. Berov uzcha, in the great strength that you have. Rashi says, this is in the forces of nature in which God shows his power, like an earthquake, a volcano, those extraordinary natural events that show that there is like this incredible force that's held in rain and that from time to time bursts forth to show you that it's not all placid. But others say that this ma'asecha is your everyday deeds. Uzcha is when we see God's strength through not only extraordinary natural events, but actually miraculous events. Nevertheless, yekachashu lecha oyvecha. Those that are your enemies, God, deny you. And Malbim wants to go and say that in this phrase you should say, im kol ze. Nevertheless. Right? He calls on everybody, recognize how awesome are your deeds, how great is your strength. Nevertheless, your enemies are the deniers, they deny you. The notion that Hashem would also continue to intervene and didn't just start this process, but actually is aware, is conscious, knows what's going on, that's the second stage. So first we have to have that stage. They deny you. Kol ha'aretz yishtachavu lecha. Ultimately, all of earth, all humanity will bow to you. Ve'yizamru lecha. Yizamru shimcha. They will sing to you. They will sing your name, Selah. We don't know what the word Selah means. Well, how do they translate Selah? Some places are smart enough just to write the word Selah because they don't know what to do with it. Some say it's forever, and some say that Selah is a musical notation that it means a flourish, silsul. Lechu uru mif'alot elokim. Go and see God's mif'al, his production, what he does. Look at it. Open your eyes. Nora alila al bnei Adam. See his awesome designs about human beings. Such as what? Now comes the miracles. Remember Malvin's structure? Hafach yam liyabasha. He turned the sea to dry land. Yamsuf. Benahar ya'avru beregel. They crossed the river by foot. This was when they crossed the Jordan and the Jordan split. Sham! There! Nismechabo. We rejoiced with him. Where is there? Some say later on in Beit HaMikdash. Some say Sham. Well, what does it say when the people saw the splitting of the sea? Vayaminu b'Hashem u'b'Moshe avdo. Now they believed in God and in Moshe. You see, until then it was okay. I get it. Ah, but now I saw it. Now they rejoiced. So Sham was at Yamsuf. Sham was the next generation when they had to cross the Jordan. Once upon a time, it was a raging river when they diverted it, and it split. You saw something extraordinary happening, and this is what occurred. Moshel bigvurato olam. What did they see when they rejoiced? They saw that he, in his strength, governs olam. Now, what does the word olam mean? Le'olam, forever. Olam, the world. Ne'elam, mysterious. So olam can mean time, and therefore it means forever. If it's space, it means he rules with his strength the entire universe. And if it comes from the concept of ne'elam, it means that it's not only the world that we see, it's also the world that we don't see. Einav bagoyim titzpena. His eyes watch out amongst all the nations. He actually sees what everybody's doing, not just us. Hasorerim al yarim ulamu. And therefore, the rebellious ones, the ones that swerve away, will not raise against him, cannot rise against him. What will he do? And the next word is Selah. It means there will be ultimate reward. Comes immediately, Hadak, and says as follows. B'kibbutz galuyot, when the gathering of the exiles will occur, God will rule over all nations. They will come ultimately to recognize him. And it is our hope that we're living through that era that's begun. The beginning of this process. Then, unlike us, now God will judge them. Now, God is slow to anger against Rishoyim. So evil, in order to allow people to be free, when evil occurs, God does not send a thunderbolt and immediately wipe them out. See, it's slow, and we don't see immediate reward and punishment, which misleads people. In Milz Hashem and Moshiach comes, we will finally see the recompense, both for the good and for the bad. It will then occur. That is why it's written in the prophet Malachi, the last of the prophets. Malachi writes, Veshastem ureitim ben tzadik l'rasha. You will come again and see that there is a difference between the righteous and the evil. Because people will have said, there's no difference between righteous and evil. They both die. We see suffering of good people and flourishing of evil. Bein oved l'asher lo avadu. To those who worship God and those that do not. It will occur at that time. And what will happen is, those who were sorerim, who were rebellious against God, will not rise again. Right now, who rises? The most powerful, including sometimes the most evil. They sometimes have more power than others. Baruchu Amim Eloheinu. Bless God, all the nations. Bless our God, all the nations. The Hashmiu Kol Tehilato, and give voice to the sound of his praises. He's asking all humanity to join us. For why? Hasan Nafshenu Bachaim. Hasan Nafshenu Bachaim is a term that is used by survivors of accidents, of the Shoah, of those who made it by the skin of their chinny chin chins and managed to survive. They put our souls among the living. In other words, we were among the dead, and they got us out and put us among the living. Because the soul survives regardless, so it'll be among the living. Hasam nafshenu b'chaim. He allowed us to remain alive, but went a step further. Ve'lo natan lamot ragleinu, and didn't let our feet stumble. Some survivors gave up. Some survivors hid from their children that they are Jews. I won't have my child go through this again. Some survivors said, I cannot worship or be loyal to a God that let this happen. And so they fell, they stumbled because of their suffering. The one that sings this says, I suffered, I survived, and I did not let myself stumble in the process. Ki bechantanu Elohim, for you have tested us, God. Tzraftanu ketzrof kasef. You have purified us as one purifies silver in a crucible. What do they do with silver? You put it in a crucible and you heat it up, and a lot of it gets burned off, and what survives is pure. Which means many will not have made it, but those that did come out ahead. Hey, Vetanu Bamtsuda, you brought us into a mitsuda, is a fortress. He was taken to a fortress, into a dungeon, if it was Menashe. But if it wasn't Menashe, it's us. We were put into prisons, into camps, into dungeons. Santa Muaka Bemotneinu. Muaka is this heavy weight. In this case, according to Malbim, it is put around your waist. They used to tie prisoners that would be taken to with chains around their waist as well as around their neck, and they would be tied to each other. So you put it, but it's also this weight that takes me down. I can't rise up as a result of it. Hilkasta enosh l'rashenu. You put humans, mere mortals. Enosh is different from Adam. It's mortals. They rode on our head. You know, like you would ride a horse? They rode us. Banu ba'esh uvamayim. We came through fire and we came through water. And you finally took us out. Revaya is a quenched, fertile, beautiful land. You brought us back. So if I go through fire and water, in this case it's like being through the sea, salty water. I've been through fire and now I have to, you know, to revive you with a little bit of fresh water. Avo beitcha be'olot eshalem lechan ledarai. I promise, and these were promises and oaths he made when he was in trouble. If you just get me out of this, I will come to your house and bring offerings. I will pay my oaths to you. Asher patsu sfatai, which my lips had expressed, v'dibel pi, and which my mouth spoke, betzarli, when I was in trouble. Olot mechim me'alelach, I will bring you fat, rich offerings. In ktoret elim, I will bring you the burnings of the rams. That's when they used to take the innards and the fat of it and burn it. Ese bakar im atudim, and Sforno explains, the bakar was for olot and the atudim was for chatat. I will bring offerings of thanks, but I will also bring offerings of sin offerings to atone for what I had done. Selah. And now comes the last part. Lichu Shimun ve'asapera. Go and listen, and I will tell. Kol yirei Elohim, to all that fear God, asher asa lenafshi, what he did for my soul. Elav pikarati, my mouth called out to him, v'romem tachat leshoni, and I sang, I uplifted him, it was under my tongue, which means it, even things that I couldn't express was there. Aven imraiti bilibi lo yishma Adonai. And the evil thoughts that were in my heart, God chose not to listen to. What was the evil in his heart, according to Malvin? Forno says, even while I prayed, in the deepest of my heart, there was still doubt whether God actually hears our prayers. And if that's the case, perhaps God is really not different than the idols that do not hear and do not see. But what happened then? That's why he says, but God chose not to listen. Because if even while he was crying out for help inside, he questioned. Achen shama Elohim. Indeed God heard. He kshiv bekol tfilati. He listened to the sound of my prayer. Baruch Elohim. Asher lo hisir tfilati. Blessed is God that did not throw out or remove my prayer. You would presume that a prayer that's a half-hearted one would have been cast out and did not remove chasdo, his undeserved love. There's no selah, because it's the end of the poem.